Hello, and welcome to our podcast, In the Same Vein, a podcast out of the Department of Health Humanities and Bioethics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. I am Dr. Christy Slobogan, Assistant Professor of Health Humanities and Bioethics here at Rochester.
And I'm Caleb Pruce, third-year medical student at the University of Rochester. We're joined today by Nicola Harris, who is a professor of medieval history at SUNY Ulster. Her research focuses on pre-modern health and healing, particularly her area of lapidary medicine, which is the use of minerals in the development of Western pharmacology. So Nicola is well accomplished. She's the president of Medica, the Society of the Study of Healing in the Middle Ages. Her recent publications, which we talk about today, include The Protection of Innocence, Red Coral as a Lapidary Cure for the Children's Disease and Conditions Related to Childbirth in Medieval and Early Modern England, in the edited volume, Death and Disease in the Medieval and Early Modern World, and the article, Lodestones Are a Girl's Best Friend, Lapidary Cures, Midwives, and Manuals of Popular Healing in Medieval and Early Modern England. Looking forward, her current project is a monograph under contract with Routledge entitled The Virtue of Stones, an Intellectual and Cultural History of Lapidary Medicine in the Pre-Modern West.
Yeah, so Caleb and I read those two publications that he just listed, The Protection of Innocence and Lodestones Are a Girl's Best Friend, which is an excellent title for a chapter in a book. And so we talked to her primarily about the work that she does in those two pieces. We got her to explain to us what lapidary medicine actually is, why it's medicine and not magic or superstition. We talk about a lot of different objects and their medical properties in the medieval and early modern era. So we talk about coral, we talk about lodestones, eagle stones, pearls, diamonds, ambers, sapphires, all of that. And we also talk about how some of these ideas around lapidary medicine and some of these treatments can actually still be seen today in health and wellness and medical care. So it's a really interesting and different episode for us and for this podcast. And so, yeah, Caleb, I'm really, really glad that you wanted to talk to Nicola Harris for this episode.
Yeah, I was excited to talk to Nicola, too. And I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to bring a medievalist on the podcast, which is probably going to be the only pre-modern medical scholar that we have.
You never know. Never say never.
Yeah. I first got interested in the medieval and pre-modern periods in undergrad, and I was an English major and ended up pursuing that further with a master's in medieval English at Oxford. And it was kind of there that I started engaging with some of the medieval medical texts and particularly the medieval medical manuscripts, which put me in contact with different scholars and eventually led me to Nicola Harris, who I found out it was local. She's at SUNY Ulster, and she's a pretty large figure in the field now. She's the president of Medica and has been involved with the American Association for the History of Medicine, which I had the opportunity to present at a couple years ago. And hopefully I can see her there this year. And it was great to meet her virtually. You know, it's often been said that medievalists have a higher threshold for boredom than most people. But I want to say that this episode is anything but boring. And I think you'll agree that not all medievalists do boring research.
Okay, yeah. Excellent. I love that. We're so happy to have you with us on our podcast.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So, Nicola, you study lapidary medicine and stones. And so just wanted you to tell our listeners a bit about what lapidary medicine is and what made you get into study of stones and their healing properties in the first place.
All right. So there's a bit of a story there. So lapidary medicine is a term that I coined in my dissertation at Rutgers to describe what I would describe as a branch of pre-modern pharmacology that hadn't been recognized as such at the time that I started looking at it. I've always been interested in material culture, so objects from the past, particularly jewelry, that tells us a bit more about the lives of people. So when I say jewelry, I don't mean like the crown jewels. I mean utilitarian pieces, things like teethers for babies or amulets with some inscription or a pilgrim's badge. And at the same time I was interested in those objects, I was, you know, reading bits of pieces of medieval literature here and there, and I would see mentions of, you know, like in the Canterbury Tales or a medieval poem that would talk about an amulet that would, you know, ward off the effects of poison or a particular stone that cured the plague. And so when I got to graduate school, I really kind of knew what I wanted to study more of, that that's something that I really wanted to look into. So the first thing I did was I, you know, started finding every book that I could on medieval medicine. And I would immediately just start flipping through it, thinking I'll find the section that talks more about this because that's what I was interested in. And I couldn't figure out like why that was not in any of the books. And then I would get another book and look for something else and, you know, trying to find this hunt of where was the book that described, you know, more about that. And then when I did find a mention of, you know, a ring or an amulet or a stone being used for something, it was always in books about the history of religion or magic. And it was like a mention here or a mention there. And the way that the authors presented it or cited that particular instance, it was always as sort of a one-off. It was kind of like, if you remember, I think in like the 80s, there was like a craze of people using like a rabbit's foot. You'd see like a little rabbit's foot dangling from a keychain or something like that. And so they kind of would cite examples of stones being used to heal or like ward off either environmental concerns or like physical concerns as like an example of the oddities of medieval culture. That it was just sort of a weird thing or a superstitious thing or sort of a one-off thing. So at the same time, I was looking at lapidary. So lapidaries are texts that are specifically devoted to the properties of stones. They are like mineralogical treatises or texts of medicine. And they go through and they list, you know, it might be 10 gemstones, it might be 80 gemstones. And it will list where they come from or what they look like, and then their properties, that they will heal you from gout or protect you from dropsy, or they'll aid you in childbirth. And the introduction to those texts always starts off with it like a disclaimer that says that stones are the products of nature, and that nature or God, when they're a medieval text that is being seen in like a Christian cosmology, they always say that, you know, God has created everything in nature and he is given stones particular virtues that will heal and protect, you know, just like herbs, but stones are more powerful. And lapidaries always describe the healing properties of stones as medicine. So I was confused when I would find mentions of these practices in works on religion and magic, and they would always describe them as superstition or practices of magic in the Middle Ages. When, you know, if you're reading the text, they're not considering it to be magic. They're considering it to be medicine. And so I sort of put that topic forward when I was at Rutgers, and I said, this is what I want to study. And I think a lot of the faculty were confused, and they were, you know, they would say, you mean you want to study crystal healing? You know, do you practice crystal healing? Is that something that you do? And I was like, no, I want to look at lapidaries, and I want to look at sort of lapidary medicine. And luckily, I was blessed with the fact that there was a faculty member there named Rudolf Bell, who was a very well-known historian of the Renaissance and medieval history, focusing on women. And he had written a book called How to Do It that was about manuals of sex, but sex in terms of procreation. He studied Renaissance manuals that would give advice on how to successfully conceive a child, how to raise a child. And he, I suppose, saw some sort of connection and realized that, you know, this was kind of similar to what he did, and he was willing to take on the project. And unfortunately, we lost Rudy in the pandemic, but he was, you know, he inspired a lot of people, and he was just a wonderful advisor. Anyway, so I remember, though, the first kind of official meeting that I had with him about my dissertation topic, and he said, okay, I'm with you. I believe that this is a field of medicine or a subsection of medieval and ancient healing, but you have to call it something. You have to have a name for it. And so he's like, go home, come up with a list of names of what you're going to refer to this as, come back. And so I made a list of names, and the one that we settled on was lapidary medicine, because I really wanted to focus on the fact that this is medicine, not magic, not religion, not superstition, that this was a sort of comprehensive system of healing. And in that sense, I've really kind of been guided by anthropologists, because so many historians of the 20th century, they look at medieval culture and particularly healing, and it seems so very different from modern day conceptualizations of healing and effectiveness, and just, you know, it doesn't really fit in with our modern day understanding of medicine. So they would try to label things as magic or as superstition or a practice of religion. And so I really benefited from an anthropologist's work. Her name is Hildred Gertz. And she says that you should view a practice according to how that culture, that, you know, native culture labeled it and considered it. So look at what they're saying. And they're not saying magic. They're saying medicine very, very clearly. So for me, that was sort of what has always influenced and led my argument that it is medicine. And so from then on, I started looking from the ancient world and then moving forward in time, tracing sort of the dissemination and circulation of ideas about lapidary medicine, starting with texts in the ancient world, which, you know, the ancient Greeks and Romans are writing mineralogical treatises that are then picked up and incorporated into Byzantine and medieval medicine. And then it's expanded in the early modern period. And then elements of it are still present with us today. There's things at your modern day pharmacy that absolutely are the product of this development of medicine in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, we definitely want to talk more about that later on in the episode for sure.
Yeah, but we didn't know that you were the one that coined that concept of lapidary medicine, because it just sounds so natural to describe what you're talking about. But then that got us thinking about what the word lapidary comes from. And like, you know, can you just speak about what a lapidary, or, you know, what that is?
So lapidary means, well, it comes from the root for the word for stone. And so a lapidary, I mean, many people have heard of herbals, right? An herbal is a text that talks about the properties of plants. So I always had to start my like conference presentations. I do still to an extent by explaining what lapidary medicine is and just sort of explaining the conceptualization of pharmacology in the ancient, medieval, and early modern world, which really starts with this idea that from the classical period, that everything in nature, every product in nature is designed for the use and benefit of mankind. And then in the Middle Ages, nature is replaced by God. So everything in the natural world is created by God for the use and benefit of mankind. And so those pharmaceutical objects are divided into three major categories: plants, animals, and stones, like animal, vegetable, and mineral, right? People are familiar with that. And so herbals, you know, we use plants for healing in many, many ways today. And people, I don't think, realize it, but, you know, when you take a vitamin, it's like vitamins and minerals. If you go to the pharmacy, there's tons of supplements for magnesium or for zinc or for all sorts of things like that. And that's not considered magical to use zinc. You know, the texts are calling it medicine. So I'm using the term that they're using. And it's just like using an herb. And it's so funny, especially at the Renaissance Society of America conference that I went to in, I think it was in April, there were people in various different panels that just commonly used the term lapidary medicine. So it's just, you know, it's like a 15-year journey maybe, but from struggling and trying to convince anybody to give me a chance to make this argument and, you know, fending off questions at conferences that seemed very skeptical of the arguments that I was making, to conferences where people are just generally using that term. But I think that I was lucky probably to be doing my research at the time that I was, because it might not have been as well received had I been doing it in, you know, the 70s or the 80s. You know, the 21st century, I think people have a much more expanded definition of many things, including the history of medicine or what medicine is.
I love that so much. It must be so gratifying to hear people using that term. So in preparation for talking to you, Caleb and I read two of your articles together. And the main objects that you speak about in those pieces are eagle stones, lodestones, and coral. So for our listeners, could you just expand on what exactly those things are and what were considered their pharmaceutical or healing properties in this period?
They're just three of the objects that you might see in a lapidary. A lapidary might have 80 different objects that it describes, mineralogical objects. So eagle stones are sort of a mystery, a bit of a mystery. So in their most basic sense, they're a round hollow geode that kind of looks like an egg. They're always described as like egg-like in appearance. I think that's just because they're round or maybe oval. And they often contain dust or a crystal fragment or some part of the interior of the geode. If it's like an iron hydroxide nodule that has formed around clay or some sort of sediment, and then that dries and that's pulled away from the outer shell, they're, you know, they have something loose that's rattling around inside them. And in that sense, they resemble an egg even more, that when people in, you know, the ancient medieval world would find one of these objects, they often note that you can hear it rattling. You can hear that it's an object that seems like a stone that is pregnant with another stone. So people in the ancient world started something called a doctrine of signatures, that nature, according to them, marks physical objects, especially pharmaceutical objects, with a sign in their appearance that tells you what you can use them for. So in that sense, eagle stones that look like eggs, which brings to mind fertility, and has that rattle, so it seems pregnant with another object, that those can be used to aid conception or can be used for pregnancy. And so eagle stones specifically are an example of a lapidary object that's use and description is consistent for 2,000 years. So we see them using it in the classical world, and we see them using it in the 17, 1800s. And you can still, many of these things, like eagle stones, you can buy them on Etsy or other sort of sites today. I'm not sure who's buying them, but, you know, they're there.
We should have bought some to shake in front of the microphone.
We should have.
People can hear that part of the podcast.
Do an eagle stone ASMR.
Yeah. There's a lot of these stones. I mean, one of them is called a cockstone because it was thought to have been found inside of roosters, inside of birds, in like the gizzard of birds. And apparently, people today, I don't know, find them in turkeys or turkey gizzards. Because if you go onto Etsy, they are selling, you know, little vials of these cockstones that are like a type of, almost like a type of bezoar stone, where it's like, I guess, undigested vegetable matter that kind of looks like these little stones. And I mean, for them, it kind of looks like a coarse sand, what I see on Etsy. And it does kind of resemble the descriptions in ancient lapidaries.
Do you ever buy any of these things off of Etsy just to see?
I have ordered, especially when you ask about lodestones. I did buy a bunch of lodestones. And yeah, I have collections of certain things. I bought a bunch of garnets to try to see how hard or soft they might be, to see if I could drill or manipulate them in the way that some of the lapidaries talked about. Or tourmaline, they often describe in lapidaries as tourmaline and amber, to be able to attract like pieces of straw. So like if you do rub a piece of amber you can, it does kind of get like a static electric charge and you can pick up stuff. And then tourmaline apparently is supposed to be piezoelectric, meaning that if you heat it or cool it in a certain way, then it kind of has that attractive force that it will pick up pieces of, they say straw, but you know, you might be able to use like pieces of paper. I've never been able to get the tourmaline to work, but mineralogists tell me that it is a thing.
Yeah. You know, I was a chemistry and English double major in undergrad, so I'm really trying to follow this physical chemistry you're describing with these stones. It is interesting that you've had to consult with some geologists, and I heard you even mention iron hydroxide nodules and like the formation of like geode formation. How much geology have you had to learn to do this research, and how much have you had to consult with geologists about it?
Well, especially during the lodestones article, the lodestones are a girl's best friend, I was emailing geologists quite often, you know, taking a description of a mineral from a lapidary and just saying, what does this sound like to you? Like, could a lodestone do this? Does this seem to be hematite or magnetite? Or can you explain to me the exact like difference between the two? Lodestone, those are naturally occurring instances of magnetized iron oxide or magnetite. And so they have the ability to attract iron, like, you know, we all know magnets. That property of a lodestone to be able to draw on iron and pick up iron is something that is remarked upon in pretty much every lapidary. So you see that over and over again in Greek and Roman, medieval, early modern texts. It's like the most widely cited instance of that idea of the doctrine of signatures. So an eagle stone, you can see the shape of it and you can hear that it's pregnant with another stone to tell you that works for fertility. But with a lodestone, the virtue is not apparent by looking at a lodestone. You know, it just looks like a kind of a gray, black rock. So it doesn't tell you what you can use it for, but it does reveal, according to the lapidaries, it does reveal its properties by, you know, that you can visibly see that it's pulling on iron. And so that's where we get that concept of occult properties. So a manifest property, something that you can see from the shape, would be like an eagle's stone is an example of a manifest property that you can see. But an occult property, it's hidden from the eye. So looking at a lodestone, you can't see what it's used for, but you can see it. There's like a hidden virtue inside that somehow pulls on that iron. But for me, I was studying the use of lodestones for childbirth. That originally, lodestones were used to test the fertility of your wife. That there's this very common tale in medieval texts and lapidaries that talk about how if you're not sure if your wife is faithful or if she loves you, you hide a lodestone under your bed or under your mattress. And then if she loves you, she will immediately embrace you. And if she doesn't love you or she's unfaithful to you, she will immediately fall out of bed.
Yeah, we definitely wanted to talk about that use of lodestones.
Yeah, so that's super common and you see it over and over again. But in the Middle Ages, some of the mendicant friars, they tend to ignore some of the more fanciful stories that are in lapidaries, and they focus on just the medicinal effects. Albertus Magnus, in particular, is very interested in magnets. He expresses this idea that some magnets draw like on iron, but then he believes that there are other magnets that can draw on flesh. So he kind of transposes or transfers those properties. So for him, it's drawing the flesh of a husband and wife together. And in that sense, if you're like hugging and embracing, there's a better chance that you're going to create a child, that your fertility is kind of increasing. So then he thinks if it can pull flesh and push flesh apart like that, that it must be able to be used to pull the flesh of a child out of the flesh of the mother. And so then... So eagle stones are consistent for fertility across 2,000 years. Lodestones are an example of a lapidary object that originally has one use, but then through various different authors, as this idea travels through various different lapidaries, there's an author who conceives of a new use for it or sort of evolves ideas and uses about a particular object. When we get into like the 17th century, if you look at pharmaceutical manuals that are put out by the official Royal College of Physicians in London, they're listing lodestones or magnetite as something that will cure gonorrhea, so curing STDs, and they're using it as like an internal cure, but only for women. So they're specific that it's will cure gonorrhea, but only in women. So it's interesting that they never, it's never about the men's infidelity mm-hmm. or the male STDs, at least in terms of lodestones, but it's only applied to women.
That's so interesting. I guess kind of shifting gears slightly, but still, at least, you know, in the present day, more like feminine association. But I was really interested in the line between aesthetics and medicine and thinking about jewelry, because a lot of the things you're talking about, you know, you mentioned garnet, which is like a birthstone that people wear in jewelry now all the time. So I'm wondering if the gemstones that you talk about in lapidary medicine, everything from diamonds to rubies to garnets, were thought of as precious stones kind of as they are now. So like, what's the line or the difference between these things being worn as jewelry for aesthetics versus being worn as jewelry for medical purposes? Yeah, I was just really interested in that kind of difference, or if it's a kind of false dichotomy that I'm making in my head here.
Well, it shifts. So in the ancient world, somebody like Pliny the Elder, when he's including a book on gemstones or minerals in his Natural History, which is this great sort of encyclopedia that he's compiling on natural objects. So he's giving everything. He has everything from lodestones to diamonds to marble to sulfur, all of these things. And in ancient pharmacology, you see sort of all sorts of different minerals. In the Middle Ages, it's more common to have articles of jewelry. So the stones that, like diamonds or garnets or topaz or tourmaline, those are more emphasized and I think used more because that's more easy for a common person to wield that sort of medicine, that you have a ring that you simply put on and that you can share, that you can pass down. That's something that a common person could do as opposed to, you know, grinding sulfur up and mixing it with other things. But keep in mind that the stone, when I say diamonds in particular, that they're not the diamonds that we have today. They're not the clear, white, beautiful, faceted diamonds. That most of the stones that are at least the gemstones people would recognize, they're what we would consider to be like industrial grade. So many of them are not beautiful. They're not clear. And they're not faceting stones until, you know, the early modern period. When I looked at the apothecary records of a particular apothecary wholesaler called Estwick and Coningsby from 17th century London, they have diamonds and emeralds and sapphires. They have all of those stones listed as things that they're selling, either for them to make some sort of pharmaceutical remedy or for people to buy and make it themselves. But strangely enough, I know people will hear sapphire or diamond and they'll think that wow, that is something that must be extraordinarily expensive, that was available to relatively few people. But they're actually not. They're definitely not the most expensive thing at the apothecary. I mean, they're not cheap, but they're on the sort of low to medium end of the price scale. And it's because it's not a beautiful glittering sapphire. It's what we would consider to be sort of an industrial grade of it. So you see, ancient world, they're really focused on pharmacology. Middle Ages, it's more sort of articles of jewelry with stones. And then when you get into the 15, 1600s, there's the rise of sort of Paracelsian medicine and mixing formulas. And so then they really get back to those objects that really can be manipulated and ground up and burned and included in something that you can ingest. I've noted that a lot of ancient and medieval jewelry, it's open-backed. And I remember being told, you know, in a modern sense, that jewelry is open-backed so that, I don't know, the light can enter the stone or make the stone sparkle more or something. But ancient and medieval texts tell you very clearly that you want the stone to come in direct contact with your skin and your body so that the properties of the gemstone, the virtues, the healing virtues of that particular object, a stone, can enter into your body. And so they want that direct skin-to-skin contact. And in the Middle Ages, it's not always like wearing an amulet. It might just be strapping that stone to your thigh or strapping it to your arm or just pressing it against something so that the properties of the stone can be transmitted.
I've seen very often those recipes and remedy books for making a plate of lead, you know, that to wear the amulets of lead. But I do think it's interesting you talked about kind of the change and how they were using these stones throughout the different periods. We're talking about how it seems like some of these ideas were kind of floating around some texts and then things kind of accelerated over time. And we just wanted to ask about the different fads in these stones. Like, were they popular in some periods and not in others? And even you talked about looking at the apothecary inventories. You know, what would happen if this was something that people are reading about, but they can't get their hands on?
So lapidary medicine for me is remarkably consistent and it is remarkably widespread. As I studied more and more of it, and I would find more and more lapidaries and then more and more, especially in the early modern period, printed popular texts that would describe to people how to practice lapidary medicine and how to use minerals for various different things. And so it is remarkably consistent that you see lapidaries produced in the ancient world that are labeled as medicine. It is picked up in the Middle Ages by especially the mendicant friars who are going out and spreading ideas, medical ideas. And so they're talking and teaching people how to use these stones. They're leaving out things like the fidelity test, and they're really focused on ways that stones can be used to heal and protect you from various different health problems. But in the early modern period, from, you know, the 1500s and 1600s especially, there's just this explosion of lapidary medicine because they're still using the jewelry and amulets and rings and things, but they're really focused on producing chemical medicines or practicing Paracelsian medicine. And minerals lend themselves incredibly well to those sorts of formulations just because they can be manipulated and, you know, by fire and reduced and combined with other things. So for me, it's remarkably consistent, but I think it definitely expands in the 15 and 16 and 1700s. That's why for me, your question about if it's in a text but you can't find it, it was incredibly important to me to prove practice. And there were many historians when I was working as, you know, on my dissertation that said, you can't talk about practice. You should definitely not talk about efficacy. Stay away from that. Don't mention it. Don't consider it. I think today, especially, that's something that has definitely changed. And so for me, I really wanted to find evidence of practical use. And I was very, very lucky that there is a historian, Patrick Wallace, at the London School of Economics. And through many different historians sort of asking around, do you know of any apothecary records? Has anybody found any apothecary records? Is there any apothecary records that you know of? Patrick Wallace was studying some apothecary records, and he was incredibly generous to share those with me and, you know, share the location. And I was able to go and see them. And lo and behold, there are many, many different minerals and gemstones and bezoar stones and pearls and coral and so many things, and to such a huge extent, such huge amounts, hundreds of pounds of coral, for example, in these apothecary records. So I was able to match up the practical advice manuals that were selling in 16th century England that would say, you know, take coral and do this and grind it up and add some pearls and add some like lavender and add, you know, the hoof of this animal or the gallbladder of that animal, and you mix it up and you slather it on or you ingest it, and then show that they were available in the local apothecary and they were available at such a price that most people could afford it.
Yeah, that's a really important part. And I think what I appreciated most about what I was reading is that practical element. And that's, I think today that's something that's very important for historians to understand and study. And well, speaking of the practical aspects, do you see, you talked about the minerals and seeing some of this overlap between lapidary medicine in the past and lapidary medicine in the future, but do you see any remnants of these cures in medicine today?
So that was something that the apothecary records were hugely helpful with. So there was a particular entry, and it was for calamine, which is a type of zinc, right? And it was listed in the apothecary inventories. And I'm looking at the number, and it's like 100 weight, which is more than 100 pounds. And I'm thinking, could that be a typo? Do I just ignore that? Because I'm not really sure what to do with that. And I'm looking, and then I'm trying to figure out like the specific gravity of this particular mineral. And it's really, really heavy. So it's the amount that they have on hand really only represents maybe a small barrel. But I'm like, why do they have a small barrel of this particular type of zinc? And then I'm looking at the recipes that include it, and they are sort of topical lotions for your skin. And it occurs to me suddenly that it's calamine lotion, that what they're making is that pink calamine lotion that everybody uses today. And I'm like, a small barrel is absolutely a reasonable amount to have, because, you know, you're grinding up quite a bit of it to make like a bottle of lotion. And in addition to the apothecary inventories, I also found a number of apothecary bills. These were for very, very wealthy families, and somehow some apothecary bills where, you know, an apothecary would add up over a month what he had sold to a particular family. And this one family, they're selling a lot of, he's charging a lot of money for what he terms pearl juleps. And a julep is like a sweet drink. And so you see the pearl juleps listed, and some of them are half the price of other entries. And so I'm like, why are these ones only half the price of those other ones? And then that particular apothecary listed who he had supplied that particular thing to. And sometimes it's the father of the house, sometimes it's the mother, sometimes it's a maidservant. So it was the father and the children that were getting these pearl juleps. And then it occurs to me that pearls are calcium carbonate. So they're drinking this, you know, a drink that is largely, you know, liquid calcium carbonate. And then the apothecary inventories have hundreds of pounds of Scottish seed pearls fairly cheaply in the apothecary inventories. So it's clear that lots of people are drinking these pearl drinks. And then it occurs to me that Tums and Rolaids that you see in a modern day pharmacy, lots of people I know, including my father and my husband, use a lot of Tums and Rolaids. Drinking a pearl drink seems so luxurious and seems so like, you know, Cleopatra. But I think people don't realize that freshwater pearls are a dime a dozen. Many medieval people talk about, you know, eating oysters, and that there's these pearls in the oyster, and they have to spit out all of the pearls that are in the oyster. I mean, they're not beautiful, exotic pearls. They're, you know, freshwater pearls. And that's what they had in stock in 17th century London, that they're selling fairly cheaply. And then the popular advice manuals that you can buy at the same time are telling you how to grind them up and make yourself these drinks. So, and then I also noticed actually when I have a son, and when he was little, he had colic pretty badly. And one of the things that they prescribe to children is, you know, things like Tums and Rolaids, like a children's version of them to sort of settle children's stomachs. And so that's why that pearl julep was half the price probably, because it was a half the size of the father's dose for the children. Anyway, so it's, for me, it's just, I find so much joy in being able to kind of solve a mystery of why something says something and be able to kind of see and draw those parallels between the past and the present, that we still have those same problems. And in this case, things that had been labeled as magic in the 20th century clearly have resulted in modern day common medical practices. I don't think anybody would consider Tums or Rolaids or calamine lotion to be magic. So for me, that seems like a vindication of my arguments.
I love those examples so much. I think those really illustrate, you know, one of your main arguments so beautifully. And, you know, when you first said calamine, I was like, wait a second, I haven't heard that word in such a long time. And I flash back to like being at summer camp and having tons of mosquito bites and, you know, having to use calamine lotion. And I, you know, immediately I was like, oh, right, that is a medicinal thing that I have used in my lifetime. And I love the example of your son with colic. After you'd explained the pearl drinks, I'm picturing you like grinding up pearls to put in a drink for your son.
No, unfortunately, I can just go to the pharmacy. But so that's interesting. I wonder at what point in the United States people had mostly gotten the chickenpox vaccine. Because, for example, I'm Gen X. And for Gen Xers, we all had chickenpox. So chickenpox is where everybody in my generation and before my generation had put the calamine lotion on. But today, it actually might not be that common of a connection. Fewer people might have used calamine lotion today because I think fewer people are getting chickenpox.
I don't see it that much anymore. I mean, I definitely use it a lot when I was a kid, but I don't.
No, because I don't know, maybe we have better things now, but I definitely know that, you know, from the 1600s to, you know, the 1980s, calamine lotion, it's still there, but I think it was something that most people had in their houses, maybe up until the 80s or 90s. Some people I'm sure still do, but it's probably not as common.
I think it's so great you're able to find a place and establish a place for laboratory medicine in the history of medicine. And as a medical student, I'm thinking about other medical students and doctors and why it's important for doctors and medical students to learn about the history of medicine. So I just wanted to ask what you thought were some of the important reasons to continue the study of the history of medicine, including laboratory medicine, for clinicians.
So for me, that's a really great question and one to which I don't know that I know the answer to. But what I do know is that, especially during the pandemic, friends and colleagues of mine that work on the Black Death, they were in hot demand by news organizations. You know, these were the experts in a pandemic. And so everybody wanted to hear what's the social and cultural reactions to pandemic and the legacies of pandemic. So suddenly their experiences of, you know, poring over medieval texts that talk about how the medieval world reacted to plague, that was a very, very useful insight. And I know that there's some really interesting research being done, for example, by Dr. Erin Connolly, the ethnopharmacologist. She's doing some really amazing research that is exploring the antimicrobial efficacy of ingredients from historical and traditional medical sources. So she's looking at kind of like what I was doing with calamine lotion and Tums and Rolaids. She's looking at different things with honey and vinegar to see that that's being used for wound care in the Middle Ages and to kind of test out to see. And I think she's demonstrated that they do have some measurable antimicrobial properties. And so for me, there's, I think, this wonderful interaction now in this era between lots of different disciplines that interdisciplinary studies are embraced and that we're all talking together, right? Historians, art historians, ethnopharmacologists, anthropologists. And so, you know, I think that it is just such a great time to be working in the field of the history of medicine.
Totally agree.
Something else that I had sort of noticed, it was very useful to have some perspective from physicians, was that, I don't know if you've ever seen children that have amber necklaces on. Have you ever seen a toddler?
Yes.
That is wearing one of those amber necklaces? I've been sort of scoping them out for a number of years, at least maybe 10 years at this point. And when I first saw them, they looked so much like the coral necklaces that I see in medieval art. Right? And, you know, the chapter that I wrote, which is called The Protection of Innocence, I talk about the use of coral for children. So those amber necklaces just seem so similar to how the coral necklaces is being used for children and for teething, that I would always, if I saw a parent with a child, I would always kind of ask them low key. I don't say like, oh, I'm a historian of medicine. I always say like, oh, you know, is that an amber necklace? And I always ask them two questions. Do you think it works? And where did you hear about it from? And the do you think it works? Most of them say they think it does. Some of them say that either way it couldn't hurt. And then one was like, I don't know, I don't think so, but I still have it on. And most of them have heard about it from other mothers, or they've seen it on social media, on you know, a parent's chat room. And so for me, I wanted to look into that, because amber is definitely not being used like that in the Middle Ages, that they've basically taken all of the things that coral was used and the way in which coral was used in the ancient, medieval, and early modern world, and they've sort of revived it but substituted amber. And I did find Dioscorides, who is a great Greek pharmacologist in the ancient world. He says something about amber and children, but it is not something that catches on. And I wonder if somebody somehow saw that and like that's the origin of that use of amber these days. But I'm not an expert on gemology, but the necklaces that I've seen, I sort of try to take a look at, and I don't think that any of them that I have seen are actually amber. I think they're all plastic, because amber is reasonably expensive. And, you know, it's something that is easy to make facsimiles of, but it is so interesting. So I've, you know, sort of looking into that, and I had noticed that there were letters from physicians that had written into medical journals, pediatricians complaining about parents either coming in with children that had amber necklaces on, or complaining that the children had amber necklaces on when they arrived, but the parents took it off in the waiting room so as to not show the pediatrician that they were using it. And these physicians writing into medical journals are saying, this is super dangerous. The Pediatric Societies of America are telling you not to put anything around your child's neck. It's a strangling hazard. So why are these parents doing it? And there are interesting parallels about how, you know, ideas about parenting circulate today and how they circulated in the 17th century or the 13th century.
Can you just elaborate or just say what amber is used for in this context, what parents think amber is being used for, even if it's not real?
So amber is fossilized tree resin. In the Middle Ages, or in the ancient and medieval world, they definitely know about amber. You know, some of the ancient texts talk about it being used for people with goiters. I mean, there are other uses of it in ancient and medieval lapidary medicine, but it's not one of the most popular items. And then for some sort of reason, and I'm not really sure who revives this idea that amber can be used for certain things in modern times. But so somebody had the idea, and what's on these websites is that there is an acid in the amber that when it touches your skin, supposedly leaches into your body and somehow soothes a child's gums and all of the physical ailments that are part of teething. And there are many different sort of digestive problems with teething. So my chapter on coral being used for that kind of lists out all the things that you can find in medieval and early modern texts that talk about all the problems that a child might have, fevers and all sorts of other things that are associated with teething. So all of those problems today on social media, you can find lots of people espousing amber as the solution to all of these problems. So instead of Tylenol or, you know, a certain type of teether or ice or all sorts of different things that you might have available to you today, that if you use amber, that it's a natural way to have that acid enter a child's body and aid in the relief of all of those things. Now, there has apparently been some studies, because I found them in some medical journals, where people have tried to test that. They're testing for that particular type of acid to see if it might have any effects, and their tests are saying no. They're saying that's not happening, that if it did, it's not going to cure any of those things. And like I said, you know, I didn't test any of the amber necklaces that any of these children had on, but for me, they all appeared to be not genuine amber. But again, almost every single one of the parents said that they thought it helped, and that it, even if it didn't, might as well.
That is so interesting. I really, yeah, I love these connections to the present day. I think it's really useful for, or it'll be really useful for our listeners to kind of place your work in a modern context. So to wrap up, this has been such a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. But to wrap up, we just want to hear, what are you working on next? What are you excited to work on? Are there any other curative objects that you're going to be focusing on in future pieces? Just, yeah, let us know what's next for you.
I'm currently working on a monograph that is under contract with Routledge, and it's entitled The Virtue of Stones, An Intellectual and Cultural History of Lapidary Medicine in the Pre-Modern West. So this is where I've been working on this for a very, very long time. And there are just so many lapidaries to look through and so many texts that I'm sort of limiting myself now. I'm sort of cutting myself off and saying, you know, you've looked at enough lapidaries, you need to sort of get this done. And so it's an introduction to just the general theory of lapidary medicine. But then there's chapters that focus on sort of gendered applications of lapidary medicine. There's parts that focus on those apothecary inventories. There's parts that focus on this jeweler's manual that is a lapidary jeweler working in 17th century London that has a lapidary slash sort of personal diary in which he talks about where he's getting all the gemstones from and where the stones are coming from and how much he's paying for them, how much they're worth. And then he also notes his own personal experience with different stones, that this stone is useful for this, and that he had an agate that was really useful in curing X, Y, and Z, but darn it, he sold it and he's never found another agate that really had those, that strong of properties. And now he regrets that. And, you know, don't let the diamond merchants cheat you on X, Y, and Z. And just all of these really fascinating stories.
We're so excited to for that book to come out and for that to be out in the world and to read more of your work on lapidary medicine. This has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate the invitation. I'm always more than happy to talk about lapidary medicine, and it's nice to have sort of a captive audience for this length of time. So I really appreciate the invitation. And I feel like this podcast is so wonderful. And so I'm so glad that you've introduced me to it.